Welcome to the latest episode of Vox Talks Climate Finance from the Center for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Climate change and the policies that governments implement to address it increasingly have macroeconomic impacts that are relevant for central banks. But within their remit, what actions can monetary policymakers take and what actions should they take? These are questions that Frank Elderson is well qualified to answer. He is a member of the ECB's executive board. He's co-chair of the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Risks of the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. And he was also the first chair of the Network of Central Banks and Supervisors for Greening the Financial System. You might know it as NGFS. Time magazine also chose Frank as one of its 100 most influential climate leaders in business for 2024. A couple of weeks ago, while COP29 was taking place in Baku, I spoke to Frank about what instruments are available to central banks, and specifically the ECB, the contribution of the NGFS, and the limits of monetary policy in addressing the urgent challenge of climate change. So, Frank, welcome.
Thank you, Tim. Good to be here.
When we're looking at the role of central banks in addressing climate change, what would you say to the people who start off by arguing, well, it's beyond their remit to do this?
To a certain extent, I understand that people look at a central bank and they think, okay, could you focus on price stability? Could you focus on safeguarding that banks are safe and sound?
Yeah.
And the answer, of course, is yes. That's our remit and our mandate. But central banks and supervisors around the world in the last 10 years have come to the realization that we cannot safeguard price stability, but we cannot safeguard sound and resilient banks if we don't take the climate crisis and the nature crisis into account. So we are not climate and policy makers. That is something for elected governments to do. They enter into a Paris Agreement. In the EU, they enact the European Climate Act, the CSRD, you name it. So that is not us. But I always say we look out of the window and we need to take into account these climate policies and we need to take into account the physical manifestation of the twin climate and nature crises.
In that case, Frank, should we look at it another way? Should we say that if central banks are involved in this, they should be prepared to be very explicit about what they consider that role in protecting the climate to be?
As I said, if we didn't take climate and nature into account, if we didn't realize, to just give you an example, that, you know, two summers ago, severe droughts in the EU, Rhine River dries up, so there's no navigation. And this had a measurable impact on German GDP. It has a measurable impact on food price inflation. So if we did not take that into account, we would be under-delivering on our mandate. We would just not be doing what we have been mandated to do. Now, your question is, should we be explicit about it? I think we should. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that I very much enjoy speaking with you. We try to explain why this is relevant, why banks need to manage their climate and nature-related risk, both the physical risk and the transition risk. And so, yes, we need to explain. And that is why I always use this phrase to make it very clear. We don't make the climate and nature policies ourselves in a democracy. It should not be the unelected central banks and supervisors that do that. But we cannot ignore this. So we take this into account.
Central bankers deploy the tools. And there are a variety of tools when we are talking about helping to solve this problem. Tell me about how you think some of these tools should be used. Credit operations, for example, lending to financial institutions. How can you decide whether that lending is green if you're a central banker?
Let's first define again the problem. So I understand that when people talk about climate and nature, they define in their heads that the problem is that we should tackle the climate crisis. So we should make sure that we don't get beyond the 1.5 degrees or as close as possible to 1.5, or we should make sure that species don't get extinct, etc. That is not what central banks and supervisors have been designed to do, have been mandated to do. So that's not the problem that we are on Earth for. It is, of course, a big problem for governments and for humankind. So we have to make sure that there's price stability. So we have to make sure that in the tools that we use, we take into account the climate and nature crises. To make it a little bit more explicit, how this works legally, and then I will go into some of the tools that you ask about, if you don't mind.
Yes.
So it says in the EU treaty that we have as a primary objective to ensure price stability. And then the treaty does not stop. It continues. And it says that without prejudice to that primary objective, the ECB shall contribute to the general economic policies in the union. And that word shall is important because mm-hmm. it means that there's a legal obligation. So we have a legal obligation to contribute to the general economic policies in the union as long as that does not somehow hamper the primary objective of price stability. So when we now devise our tools, so when we look at green lending, for example, or when we look at our own collateral framework, or when we designed a corporate bond purchase program, that's a good example maybe to start off with. We could have just blindly bought the outstanding bonds, saying, you know, there's a market neutrality principle, but we tilted towards buying more green and less non-green bonds out of that total market. And why did we do that? We did that because we interpreted that mandate that we have, that primary and secondary objective, in a way that we said, so if there's two ways to calibrate an instrument that we have, either tilt or not tilt, and both are just as effective to get us to the primary objective of price stability, then we have this obligation. Remember, it says in the treaty, the ECB shall support. We have this legal obligation to, at the same time, contribute to the general economic policies of the union, of which climate policies are clearly part. So this is an example of how interpreting our mandate, always having first and foremost that price stability as our clear anchor, but then at the same time, trying to calibrate our instruments, to choose our instruments in a way that kills two birds at the same time, if you like.
Who decides whether you are tilting? What is green when you are tilting towards greenness?
Everything that is decided by governments, because it's their remit, we take as a given. Why do we look at climate under our secondary objective? Because the EU is clearly defined as a priority. There's a Fit for 55 program. There is a Paris Agreement. There's a European climate law. There is a Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive. There are clear intermediate deadlines, 230 minus 55. There will be in the end also, you know, an interim deadline for 240. There is, of course, the net zero imperative in 250. All that has been decided by government. So we take our cue from there.
How does the climate crisis affect your supervisory role?
We started a conversation with the banks in 2019 already.
Yeah.
And we asked them, so do you manage your climate and nature-related risks? And less than 25% of the banks had actually done some work at that.
Wow, as late as 2019.
Yes, sir. And we thought this is clearly insufficient because, again, maybe in a second, I'll tell you a little bit about the Central Banks and Supervisors Network for Greening the Financial System, the NGFS.
Sure.
But so there was a broad coalition of central banks and supervisors around the world that around that time knew perfectly well that climate and nature-related risk translate into financial risk and therefore must be managed by the banks. So we published what we call supervisory expectations as to how banks should manage their climate and nature-related risk in 2020. And then we asked all the banks under the direct supervision of the European Central Bank, which are the 110, 112 biggest banks in the banking union, we asked them to do what we call a self-assessment. So we say, could you please check where you stand vis-a-vis these expectations that we just published? And then banks have been very sincere, and I noticed because they were very self-critical. So then we asked all the banks under our supervision to come up with action plans and say, okay, how do you get from the A where you are today to the B where we expect you to be according to our expectations? So this was in 21. And we asked the banks also, how long will it take you to get to full compliance with these expectations? And about 80, 85% of the banks at the time said, give us to the end of 23 and we will get it done. Then in 22, so we took some years, which is also logical because it was new.
Yep.
It was not something that banks did before. And we want to be proportionate. In 22, we are supervised, of course. So we don't just base ourselves on self-assessment by banks. And we did what we call a thematic review in which we actually entered into all the banks, so 110 plus, and we looked at their progress since 2020. And the good news was that there was progress. And the good news was also that all of our expectations, each one of them, was at least being complied with by one or the other bank around the union.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew, but there was no bank that complied with all, but we knew it was possible, but the speed of change was too slow. You know, when we extrapolated in 2020, the speed of change, banks would not be ready by the end of 2023, which they had themselves said that they would be able to do. So then we said, let's give banks another year just to be reasonable. But by the end of 2024, we are going to be enforcing. And that was a new step. So you ask, how do you do this in supervision? Well, we do this like this. There comes a point that we say, now you must deliver. And we did a couple of things more because we didn't just say, we will enforce and make sure that you are in full compliance with all our expectations by the end of 2024. But we also set some interim deadlines in between so that we could check whether there was the speed of progress had enhanced after 22. So without going into all the details, in March 23, there was a first interim deadline, end of 23, the second one. And now by the end of this year, end of 24, there's this end deadline. And enforcing means that those banks that, to give you an example, the first interim deadline, March 23, had to do with banks having to do a materiality assessment. So anyone who manages risk knows that first thing you do is to see, given my business model, given my geographical activities, to what extent is this material for me? So this was already in these expectations that we published in 22. But there were still a number of banks, unfortunately, that by March 23 had not done a serious, adequate materiality assessment. So for example, they had looked in some jurisdictions that they were active, but not in all. Or they had looked to some of their part of their balance sheet, but not all the balance sheet. Or just to physical risk, but not to transition risk, or vice versa. So clearly inadequate. Then what we did, we issued what we call combined decisions, which are formal supervisory decisions, of which periodic penalty payments are a part. We gave banks yet another deadline. You can see how proportionate we are. But we said, okay, but if you have not then done it, every day that you have not delivered, you will incur a fine. This is a process that luckily not all the banks, but there were a little bit more than 20, I think, where we actually started that process. But fortunately, most of those then started running. It shows that if you apply pressure as a supervisor and banks see that you mean it, they act.
Yeah, because it is December 2024. Now, Frank, you've been nice cop. Do you have to be nasty cop now with some of the banks?
I understand that you use that parlance. But what we want to make sure is that banks manage all their relevant risk. And climate and nature-related risks are simply relevant. They are material. We have all these tools and we escalate when needed. But the best thing, of course, is if people really get it, if they are convinced. I started by referring to this less than 25% number.
Mm-hmm.
Now, more than 90% of the banks say that climate and nature-related risks for them are clearly material. So banks see it themselves. I'm actually convinced that if I now were to say to you, I made a mistake and it's actually not relevant at all, sorry for the last 4 years, the banks under our supervision would say, well, Mr. Ellison, thank you very much, but we are going to continue because we know that we must manage all our material risks, and these are material, clearly. So we have gotten to that point.
Now, one aspect of managing material risk that we've previously discussed here is the stress testing regimes the banks have. Dirk Schoenmaker is very strongly of the opinion that the stress tests as they are presently constructed do not accurately represent climate risk. What's your position on that?
Let me say two things on that. First, why stress testing is so important, and then directly going to your question. Banks, of course, manage many of the more traditional risks, if you like, by looking backwards, having long series of data and statistics. But climate and nature don't allow for that because you have to develop forward-looking techniques. You have to work with scenarios, and stress testing is key. Also because of the non-linearities. Things might just not change in a linear manner. There are tipping points. Specifically your question, we at the ECB pride ourselves to be a fact-based organization, a science-based organization.
Yeah.
So if you look at the science and if you look at the IPCC, the world presently is not on a 1.5-degree baseline. It's not on a 2-degree baseline. It is on a 3.1-degree baseline. And that 3.1 assumes that governments will implement in time all their stated climate policies, which is quite an assumption to make.
Mm.
Also, if you look at the present political environment.
Absolutely, yes.
It also, the 3.1 also abstracts from tipping points. And therefore, by definition, it abstracts from compounding effects between tipping points, because one tipping point might trigger the other one. It's like dominoes, isn't it? And then, all that having been said, in Europe is the continent where temperatures increase fast. So we have to prepare ourselves for a world whilst we have to do all we can. And I'm just not saying central banks and supervisors, but governments, all of us, to mitigate climate change as much as possible. We cannot close our eyes to the fact that the IPCC reminds us that, as I said, we are on the 3.1 degree baseline, and actually it might just be worse. I do believe that the scenarios that are being used around the world, and the NGFS, this Network for Greener Financial Sector, plays a big role together with very renowned institutes like the Potsdam Institute in Berlin and others. Mm. They play a very big role in devising these scenarios. This is very complicated work. Actually, recently, lots of investments have been made in also making shorter-term scenarios. So this is an international public good that is being catered for. But I do believe that more work is urgently needed in also coming up scenarios that are more severe, because in the end, it's a tool to try to see through that foggy future and make sure that our financial system, that our banks are resilient to that future that might come. And they're the best compass that we have is the best science that we have.
In applying that science to what you do, when you look around at the European Central Bank, are you confident that you have the in-house expertise that you need? Or do you rely on third parties to fill the gaps?
The short answer is yes and yes. So there has been a lot of training, a lot of upscaling, a lot of interaction with, as I said, other central banks and supervisors around the world. So to just give you some numbers here, we founded this NGFS in 2017 with 8 central banks and supervisors. I was the first chair for first year. And in this first 4 years of the NGFS, it grew from 8 to more than 100. Today, there are 141 central banks and supervisors around the world. So working on a host of issues, climate litigation, monetary policy tools, supervision, scenarios, scope 1 of our own organizations. I mean, there's a whole range of things. People within central banks and supervisors in all these activities, they are being touched by these issues. They can no longer do their work without being called to participate in international task forces and working groups and work streams. So I think that we have made great strides. At the ECB, we have what we call a climate change center. We have hired a climate scientist, and not someone with a legal background or economic background. This is happening in other central banks as well. I know, for example, the Bundesbank does the same, and this will increase. But of course, we will never be able to insource the entire worldwide climate and nature scientific community, and we should not. Mm-hmm. So what we do is work together, interact, do multidisciplinary work, and incorporate scientific findings in our work, which is ensuring price stability and ensuring the safety and soundness of banks.
Let's talk a little bit more about how you cooperate within the Network for Greening the Financial System, the NGFS. We've mentioned it a couple of times. You were the founding chair. What was the impetus for putting central banks together to cooperate on these issues?
Go back to 2017. So this is 2 years after the Paris Agreement. It's also many decades, by the way, after the Club of Rome. It's not that humankind didn't know about climate change before, but of course, the Paris Agreement and the negotiations running up to the Paris Agreement were a huge worldwide wake-up call, also for central banks and supervisors, at least some. So some started to ask themselves the question, if the world is going to change. If we have looked at oil markets forever, and going to net zero means that at one point we will have to phase out fossil fuels, that must be relevant for us. If at one point governments are going to say that homeowners need energy efficiency certificates, and if I'm a bank and I'm heavily exposed to houses that are not isolated or that are located in flood-prone areas or in fire areas, that might just be a risk for that bank. In some central banks, people started doing work on this. And then we came together in Paris, together with the Banque de France, but also the People's Bank of China, the Central Bank of Mexico, Central Bank of Morocco. So we made sure that it was already worldwide. These existing standing setting bodies at the moment, the Financial Stability Board, the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, they were not doing any work on this. So we felt, and I very strongly felt, that I needed to create a coalition of the willing, yes, of those who had understood that this was relevant. And it was work. It was work because we started doing some rather in-depth analytical reports that you can still read now on the website, where we explain what is now very commonly known, but what was new at the time, that to understand how do then climate and nature-related risks transform into financial risk? How do these physical risk channels work? How do the transition risk channels work? So this whole intellectual framework needed to be developed. And that work was done, and it was being understood by an increasing number. And the good thing is, actually, the whole setup worked, because apart from the fact that these original 8 grew to 100 and now 141, people started taking to the other tables, the Basel Committee table, the Financial Stability Board, the Governing Council of the ECB, the Supervisory Board of the ECB, the IMF. They started taking what they had understood in a meeting of the NGFS on Monday to the meeting in any of these other bodies in the rest of the week. Because the good thing about central bankers and supervisors, these people are intellectually honest. They are academics. And once you have understood something, you can no longer not understand it the next day. So it worked. And the formal existing body started doing serious work on this.
When you look at the members you have now, you have colored in most of the map of the world. Is the bigger challenge now to develop the sort of tools that they can use and use in some sort of coordination to tackle the crisis?
Oh, this is a very relevant and also a very topical question, isn't it?
Yes.
Because we will have to see to what extent the work that has been done internationally in the standard setting bodies, how under the new constellation, to what extent those work programs will be rolled out with the same enthusiasm as they have been,
yes,
over the last years. So it might be that the role of the NGFS will become somehow we're again more relevant, as it was already there when the existing standing setting bodies were not able to do lots of work. If we were to end up in a situation which has some parallels to that period, it might just be that that coalition of the willing might regain some of its prominence just by somehow ending up to be again a little bit the only kid in town.
How big a risk is uncoordinated action? Because there is no legal reason why your members have to cooperate with each other.
But you know, yeah, that's a good question. But many of these things are really about analyzing, understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have not understood as a bank that you need to also manage your litigation risk around this, it might just be that one day you find yourself in court being accused of breaching human rights by not being on the Paris compatible path, for example. These cases are there now. The NGFS doing work on this, going back to your earlier question, being very explicit about this, communicating about this, makes banks more resilient because they will then manage these risks. And how do you manage this risk? Best by devising Paris-compatible transition plans. So many of these things actually need not to be legislated so much. They just need to be understood. And once a banker understands that this is a risk that he or she maybe has not taken into account so much, but is clearly there, then the natural reaction of all bankers is, let's take that into account. I want to be profitable. I want to be resilient. There's many examples, but maybe this is the point I want to make.
So as we speak, we're nearing the end of COP29, described before everyone came together as the finance COP. Has it lived up to what you would want from it?
Let me say this, the need for brutally scaling up finance is so clear. So to just give you one number, to stay on track to meet the Paris Agreement goals, just talking about climate mitigation. So I'm not talking about climate adaptation, which is also needed. I'm not talking about nature mitigation, neither about nature adaptation, but just climate mitigation. So to keep up with the Paris goals to 2035, we need annually the US dollar, $11.7 trillion in investments. Numbers, by the way, from UNEP, the United Nations Environmental Program.
Mm-hmm.
So this equals about 10% of global economic output. Huge numbers. And many times I talk about the fourfold financing gap: climate mitigation, climate adaptation, nature mitigation, nature adaptation. Now, not all that can come obviously, from governments. Much of this needs to be private investment. But the fact that governments have understood that finance is, albeit not a sufficient, but it is a incredibly necessary condition to reach the Paris goals, even if the results of Baku were to be disappointing, the need to get this right and the need to agree on this will not have disappeared. So I would then say that as of the next day, the imperative to continue trying to find worldwide consensus on this will be there just as much as it is today.
If worldwide consensus doesn't exist, you would press on with the coalition of the willing to do as much as you can.
Exactly. The physical manifestations of climate change, unfortunately, they don't disappear. We have now seen what has happened in the floods in Valencia. We have seen the floods in the Philippines. The effects on the banking system, the effects on financial stability, the effects on price stability, all these things are already visible today. But as climate science tells us, these events will happen ever more often and will be more intense in the future. This will not go away. So the need to take these physical manifestations into account, the need to, and taking into account, for example, also means that we need to collect the data that is needed for this, to incorporate this in economic models. It means that we need to make sure that banks manage these risks around it. That need will not become smaller, but bigger. And if one or the other jurisdiction, for whatever reason, is unable to make progress, it just doesn't make sense to close our eyes to these physical manifestations and to the transition risk at the same time.
But Frank, even if the supervisory work that you've been doing has its maximal effect, even if among your network there is huge commitment for all the central banks to do what they can, ultimately, can monetary policy do as much as a fiscal policy? And I ask this because, as we know, the political environment means that we might have less fiscal policy in favour of protecting against the climate crisis in the next couple of years?
I think this is a key question. I'm glad that you ask it. Central banks and supervisors cannot solve the climate crisis. Central banks and supervisors cannot solve the nature crisis. What we do is ensure that there's price stability, because if the world had to face these twin climate and nature crises, and on top of that, there would not be price stability, there would not be financial stability, banks would not be sound and safe, the challenge would be so much bigger. So this is what we can contribute. But without governments ensuring that at one point we live in net zero world, without a Paris Agreement, which is agreed on by governments, without a European climate law, without setting clear goals for 2030, 2040, and net zero in 2050, we will just not tackle the climate crisis. So it's very clear that in the end, this needs to be done. And in the EU, that's very clear that needs to be done by democratically elected governments and lawmakers. What we can do and what we must do is to take all this into account, both the physical and the transition risk, so that we can deliver on our mandate. And by doing so, we can contribute to creating the circumstances that will make the job easier, although still very daunting.
Frank Elderson, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
If you want to find out more about the Network for Greening the Financial System, it is at ngfs.net. And the episode of Vox Talks, during which I discussed what's missing from stress tests with Dirk Schoenmaker, was called, not surprisingly, What's Missing from Climate Risk Stress Tests, and that's from April 2023. It's easy to find if you follow or subscribe to Vox Talks Economics. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts. If you do, then you'll have access to all of our climate finance special episodes.